Welcome on in to Studio 2 on Thursday, June 27th. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. And we are going to start with some breaking news this morning. The Supreme Court struck down a provision in a major opioid settlement with Purdue Pharma. This provision would have shielded the family that owns Purdue, the Sackler family, from civil liability. And now after this tight 5-4 decision, not on party lines, by the way, the big question is, what happens to the settlement money?
To help us break it all down, we have Aneri Patani, a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Aneri, thank you for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
So I know you've been following this opioid settlement for years. As someone who lives and breathes this, what was your reaction to the Supreme Court ruling today?
I was surprised, but honestly, I would have been surprised with any decision. The oral arguments were pretty, you know, balanced on both sides. Advocates, victims, families are split on this. So I think from today's decision, you're going to have half the people who are happy, half the people who are upset. So this really was a toss-up when we're waiting to see what comes out of it.
And so what happens in the immediate aftermath? What pot of money does this affect, and what pot of money does it not affect?
Yeah. So the case today is about Purdue Pharma, their bankruptcy. And as part of that bankruptcy, the Sackler family was going to pay $6 billion in opioid settlement money that would go to a large share to state and local governments, and then some amount to victims and families of victims. So that deal is essentially off the table now. What the Sacklers have said is, you know, we will pay this money if we get immunity. The Supreme Court said you can't get immunity when your company is filing for bankruptcy. So what happens now is the case goes back to bankruptcy court, and the government, the individuals, the Purdue Pharma company have to renegotiate a new deal. And no one quite knows what that looks like.
Yeah. And Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware were all on the list to get paid some of this opioid settlement money. Will it impact the money that's going to states? Like, how will this, what's the overall trickle-down effect of this?
So that $6 billion is on hold right now. We don't know if that'll get paid, but that is only a small slice of, there are lots of different companies that are settling opioid and paying out opioid settlement cash. And so states like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, most other states are already seeing money from companies like Johnson & Johnson, CVS, Walgreens, Walmart. So there's actually billions that are being paid and will continue being paid for more than a decade to come. Purdue could have added to that. And right now, that's sort of a question mark if they will pay that out. But it doesn't mean there's no opioid settlement money. There's still plenty of other money coming from other places.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify what you're saying, the money that we've been hearing about in the local news for a while, that's starting to be dispersed. So they're making decisions about that money here in Pennsylvania, here in Philadelphia, to help address the opioid crisis today. Most of that money is still flowing.
That's correct. And a lot of it's already being used. I mean, in Philadelphia, you saw a lot of it go to the Kensington neighborhood for investments. And there's some concern as to whether that's going to be allowed or not by the Pennsylvania State Board overseeing opioid settlements. But all of that money is already in process. It's being spent across the state and across other states. This was just going to be extra money that could have added to that bucket.
By the way, the court had one of the big reasons why the court overturned the settlement was this release from future exposure that the Sacklers had for agreeing to give $6 billion. Could this overturning of the settlement mean that the Sacklers end up paying more money and therefore more money could be coming to the states?
So what it does, so yes, I guess the short answer is yes, it could mean that. It's a little bit up in the air, but basically if the Sacklers don't have immunity, that means individuals, so victims, families, can file civil lawsuits against them. State governments could do so, and they could kind of move through the legal process and try to go after the Sacklers' personal money. It's not clear if that will happen, but it is a possibility on the table.
And you mentioned earlier that this was a topic that had divided many victims' families, many advocates. What are you hearing this morning from folks who might have received some of this money?
There's a real strong split where there are a group of victims and families, folks who are in line to receive the money, who think, geez, I just wanted this case to resolve. We need the money urgently. We need it to pay for treatment. We need it to pay for funeral expenses. So they just wanted the bankruptcy deal to be approved so that the money could start flowing. They could get the payment and kind of move forward, both with a sense of closure and with actual, you know, practical needs that they needed the dollars for. On the other hand, you have folks who say the amount of money that was going to be paid to victims and families was very small. The highest amount was around $48,000, and then you subtract attorney's fees. So they were saying, you know, the money's not that much, and we don't want the Sacklers to evade responsibility for their actions. So there's a group of people who are really happy with this decision and want to see the Sacklers, you know, either taken to court or having to pay more or in some way kind of own up to their actions.
Yeah, we only have a couple more minutes before we wrap up. I got to ask you, I mean, at the very least, it could take years for a new settlement to be established. Maybe, we don't know. Can you give us an idea of what it took to get to a place of settlement with the Sacklers in the first place?
It took 3 years to get to this previous deal. You had to get the individual people, victims, families to get on board. You had to get state governments to get on board. You had to get enough of them to get on board that the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma and their lawyers agreed. So this was not an easy negotiation. And what happens moving forward will also not be an easy negotiation. And when I talked to experts in this field, they said they cannot even guess at the timeline it would take to reach another deal here.
Well, that was Aneri Patani, senior correspondent with KFF Health News. Aneri, thanks for joining us this morning on short notice.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up on the show, today is the day, Avi, the debate, the presidential debate, former President Donald Trump versus incumbent President Joe Biden tonight on CNN. I'll be watching. Will you be watching? You're going to leave that up in the air, but we have a whole panel of experts coming up for our middle segment, which we are extending today. And we're going to talk about what you can expect from this performance, what the challenges will be, the issues, whether we'll possibly get real answers to the big issues, and what the job that each candidate must accomplish for the end of the night. And we'll talk about that later. And July 1st is a big day for the Philadelphia Zoo.
She wanted to transition. You didn't give the number. 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org if you want to participate in our middle conversation. And now we're going to transition, I guess, to our newsmaker. In July of 1874, the Philadelphia Zoo opened its doors for the very first time. That's what Cherry just alluded to. And in the last century and a half, the nation's first zoo has seen a lot of changes. There have been pioneering orangutan, chimpanzee, and giant river otter births. Didn't even know about giant river otters. There was also, on the negative side, a devastating fire in the 90s. The zoo has been through a lot.
Yeah, and the nation's first zoo now houses more than 1,700 rare and endangered animals, from big cats on the prowl overhead to virtual reality under the sea. It's been a transformative 150 years of conservation and a whole lot of fun. Joining us now to talk about the history and the future of the zoo is President and CEO Joel Mogerman. Joel, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thanks, Avi and Cherry, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Take us back 150 years to 1874. I believe the admission was 25 cents for adults, 10 cents for kids. What were you seeing when you walked into the Philadelphia Zoo 150 years ago?
Well, our 3,000 guests that came that day were greeted by a brass band. And it's funny to think they came by ship, on foot, by rail, to come to the Philadelphia Zoo and see our 592 animals 150 years ago on July 1st.
That is amazing. And in the past 150 years, there's been a lot of firsts with the Philadelphia Zoo. First of its kind, animal lab, so many strides in how to feed animals. Talk about some of the innovations created by the Philly Zoo.
Oh, well, Philadelphia Zoo is known in our field as an innovator. From the first animal diets, the first scientifically designed animal diets that were called zoo cakes, to some of the successful breeding that you mentioned, And actually, the zoo was founded by physicians. And so there was a big emphasis on health and research. And I think one of the things that's interesting and brings us forward to today was the zoo's emphasis and understanding of disease transmission between humans and animals. Mm-hmm. What we know now today is zoonotic diseases. And how important that understanding that was started at the Philadelphia Zoo has blossomed moving forward. And then, of course, as you all know, we are now known for our Zoo 360 trails. Those are the trails that connect the animal habitats, that give our animals choice and change in their day. And that trail system has been replicated around the world in over 70 zoos.
What do you see as the biggest change in the way zoos are managed and run and marketed over the last 150 years? I know that's a big topic, but what do you pinpoint as sort of the big shift from then to now?
I would say the big shift, you know, we were founded with this idea that we are here for the people of the region, for education and recreation, and that hasn't changed. We're a 42-acre living classroom. But I would say what has shifted and changed is our understanding of animals and how to provide high quality animal care and welfare and well-being. And then how that then shows up in our exhibits, our habitats, how we talk about our animals. And then I would say the other two pieces that have changed are our guests. You know, today our guests have the world of information in their palms of their hands, on their phones. And so we need to provide them with experiences that really move them and motivate them to do things, different behaviors, different practices that are supportive of native wildlife and wildlife and nature across the globe.
Wow. And the zoo had some pretty famous inhabitants for a while. You've had some new babies born recently, a couple sloth bear cubs last year. What does the future look like when it comes to all the animal residents?
Oh, the future is very wonderful and amazing. You know, we're taking that idea that we are no longer the major information provider and thinking through what that looks like for experiences for our guests that touch their heart and motivate their hands for wildlife and conservation. And we want to make sure that we still remain a part of the fabric of Philadelphia and what Philadelphians do. Come to the zoo, come visit. We'll be looking at what all that means as we're going through strategic planning now. And we have another announcement that'll be coming in a few months that will show what the future will look like for the zoo.
You want to break that news right now on studio too?
No, I can't. Okay. I can't. Okay. I can't. My PR team would be very upset with me.
We'll check back in a few months. Real quick, before we get you out of here, Joelle Mogerman, climate change. Summers are getting hotter. We're seeing more, you know, dramatic weather events. How does that affect zookeeping?
Oh, that's a really great question. A lot of it actually impacts our guests a lot. You know, what I discovered, this is my first summer in Philadelphia, is we have a wonderful tree canopy. So our guests are actually able to stay a little bit cooler when they come visit. And the same is true for our animals. We provide shade in their exhibits and access to water in different forms. It could be ice in terms of enrichment to help those animals stay cool. But some of our animals, you know, they're desert species and it's kind of okay for them.
And gotta ask you, last question, are cheetahs still your favorite?
They are. They always will be. They are. They are.
All right.
Yeah.
And you can see cheetahs at the zoo, right?
I just want to clarify.
That's right. Come on out. July 1st. That's our big 150th anniversary celebration. We opened our doors on July 1st, and guests will be greeted with a brass band, just like they did 100 years ago. Yeah, and we also, in the afternoon, we'll have the Wawa Welcome America Party.
All right.
That will be from 1 to 5 with free admission from 3 to 5, but you got to come early. because we close at 5.
All righty. There you go. Those are the details. Joelle Mogerman with the Philadelphia Zoo, president and CEO. Thanks for your time this morning.
And you're listening to
Thanks for having me.
Yes. And you're listening to I Love Music by the OJs. It's our celebration of Black Music Month. A little there. We're going to have some love before we start talking with our panel of experts ahead of tonight's debate. Studio 2 will be right back. Stick with us. Lots to come.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Tonight, if you hadn't heard, is the first presidential debate, and it feels like everyone is a little on edge. This will be the third time that President Biden and former President Trump will face off. They debated twice in the 2020 election cycle, and a lot has been made about what's at stake this time around with what seems like a tight race.
So we're going to talk about what's on the line, each candidate's strengths and weaknesses ahead of tonight's event. And we have a panel of very knowledgeable folks in the studio with us. I want to say welcome to Neil Oxman, Democratic political strategist, Kelly Dittmar, associate professor of political science at Rutgers Camden, and Charles McElwee, editor of Real Clear Pennsylvania. Panel, welcome.
Thank Good you. Morning.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and if you want to join the conversation, you guys know, studio2@whyy.org. You can also give us a call, 888-477-WHYY. Don't call the pledge number if you want to call us, all right? 888-477-9499. Okay, let me start here. And real simple, folks, I'll just go around the table. Charles, I'll start with you. Number one thing you're watching for tonight.
Number one thing is watching them actually come onto the stage. That will be a riveting moment for everyone, and that's why AP has a poll out that predicts that 6 in 10 Americans are projected to watch this debate tonight because of its history, really. I mean, you're seeing a particularly early debate and a rematch. So I'll be looking for how they perform, of course, but also what they hit on, because I think they'll go to their greatest hits. And in the case of Biden, he'll be talking about how he's a candidate of stability and painting Trump as one of chaos. And Trump, likewise, will tap into what polling has shown to be Americans yearning for the economy of the Trump era and the Trump boom. So it will be interesting to watch.
Kelly, how about you? Number one thing you're looking for tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I think this one is particularly important to Joe Biden in this moment. And so looking at his performance, is he not goaded by Donald Trump? Because that will be the strategy, right? To try to goad him to get confused, mix up his words, go off cuff, in which case that's not something Biden's particularly strong with all the time. And will he get the points across on the major issues he needs to get across to bring back in some voters who are feeling pretty disillusioned?
Good stuff.
Neil?
Debates are about style, not about substance. You can't screw the substance up. I mean, you can't make the mistake that Gerald Ford did, you know, back in that campaign or other things that you can think about. But this really is a debate about style. And it is a debate about – it is a chance in 90 minutes to either dispel some of the stuff that's out there or it's going to be reinforced. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's baked in. For Biden, unfortunately, his age is baked in. The border is baked in and inflation. And for Trump, it's all the craziness. And so what happens to either – you know, confirm or dispel that, and how are they over 90 minutes? Not because they have the right 1 minute and 50 second answer about the economy, but it's, you know, it's about do you like these people by the end of it and do you trust them and all those other adjectives other than do they pass or flunk the test in terms of the substance?
Yeah. We talked about how this is the third debate, the third time these two candidates have kind of squared off. The first time the two men debated each other back in 2020, the COVID pandemic had ramped up. Trump was incumbent president. Biden wanted his spot and came out swinging. I want to take a listen to a memorable clip from their first debate.
I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
The
you
question
put a
is,
lot of
the
new
question
Supreme
is,
Court justice, the radical question, left.
Will you
who
shut
is
up,
on,
man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
who's
is
on your
so
list?
Right.
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
He's going to pack the court.
We're not
going to give a list.
We have ended this segment. We're going to move on.
Woo, woo, woo. People really hated that first debate. It was hard to listen to, hard to follow. Second debate, much better. But a lot has changed since 2020. Can you, Kelly, I want to start with you. Can you just tell us what are the big differences from then to now?
Yeah, I mean, in this case, obviously, we're talking about a different incumbent. So it's different when you come into the debate being the incumbent. We know that incumbents in the past have struggled, actually, in first debates because they don't have as much breadth. They're a little more confident or overconfident. I think that's different with Biden. I think he knows that the stakes are really high here, but it still is a different dynamic between these two. It's also not during COVID. So what we were seeing every day in 2020 going up to these debates enduring was we were seeing Trump on TV every day. There was a lot of questions about whether or not he was doing this job well. He had the expertise. So there was a different backdrop for the race than there is today for both candidates. So I think those are two big things. And then, of course, obviously the rules. So the lack of muting, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that, how that changed into the next debate. But I think that will be different here, too. And so Biden, in the case he's being goaded as he was in that clip, will he react? It will be weird if the audience can't hear it and then he reacts to it. So there are some dynamics that both campaigns have to be prepared for in terms of style, as Neil was saying, to be sure that they come across clearly and it doesn't look like they're speaking out of turn.
Yeah, let's get into the rules now. That's a nice segue because as you heard in that clip, a lot of crosstalk. Mm-hmm. It seems like that will, I don't want to say eliminated, but be muted this time around. Charles, what do you make of the debate rules, and do you think they favor one candidate over the other?
One can make the argument that at first glance that the rules favor Biden, considering that there won't be an audience, that the opposing candidate will be muted when the other talks. But that capture that clip that you shared earlier captures an underrated moment in the 2020 campaign. Even Trump supporters were frustrated and disgusted over Trump's performance in that first debate. And I think the style that one should be looking out for tonight is how Trump is now compared to what he was in 2020. If you watch him on the campaign trail now, he's closer in style to how he was in 2016, injecting humor and appears far more disciplined than that time. Biden, of course, has aged, and this will be the ultimate display. Biden was the one who pushed for this debate, so we'll see if that was if that plays in his favor or if he'll regret it.
And I just want to be clear, tonight's debate is hosted by CNN. It's going to be in their Atlanta studio. Mics are going to be muted unless the candidate is directed to speak. There are no pre-written notes. Each candidate will get a pen and paper, bottle of water, coin toss to determine position of podiums and order of closing statements. Neil, I want to bring you back into the conversation. No audience. The impact of what do you think will be the impact of no audience on the performance of each of the candidates?
Well, because you're not playing to an audience in the sense of people in the room, you know, you have to think about it differently versus the way it was 4 years ago. I think that the muted mics, at least probably mm-hmm. for Trump, will not stop him from talking. Mm-hmm. They're only 8 feet apart.
Yeah.
And Dana Bash and Jake are, you know, just a few feet away. And so I think that, you know, I don't know if the cameras will be doing two shots or a single shot, but if they're on Biden and Biden says something that Trump doesn't like, I think Trump is just going to talk, and I think he's going to talk loudly.
You're going to hear like sort of a distant voice.
Yeah, but see, I think Avi, it's about not about the home thing. It's about getting into Biden's, you know, it's about screwing around with Biden,
Because I thought maybe that the muted mics could save Trump from himself. If people didn't like the fact that he was always interrupting, if you can't really hear the interruptions, maybe that plays to Trump's favor. But you're saying, Neil, Kelly,
you're agreeing. If Donald Trump was normal, given the fact the right direction, wrong track for the country is 28 to 68 negative, the fact that it's 350 for a gallon of gas, that, you know, we're unsure in the world where we are, that most normal people are worried about the fact that eggs and bread and milk are twice what they were. If Donald Trump was a normal human being, was John Huntsman, was Mitt Romney, comported himself like a normal human being, he'd be 10 points ahead in this campaign. So, yes, I mean, what he should do is be respectful. I respectfully disagree with the president. This is what I would do. I would tariff everything that comes out of China. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that. If it did, I think the few independents who are left, because you know, every one of the seven states are within a couple of points, he might steal some of those, but you never know. I mean, he's never been normal his whole life. So why should tonight be any different?
Yeah. And if you want to participate in this conversation, what do you think? What would you be looking for? Are you going to watch the debate? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. I want to read in a comment from John who says, the decision was made for me in 2020, so there's no need to invest any more time. So John is out. He's not watching tonight. But I want to bring you back into the conversation, Kelly and Charles, because, you know, what would be your advice? Because Neil brought up a good point, the muted of the mic. Trump will likely keep talking. What would be your advice, Kelly, to Biden in dealing with something like that this time, given what happened back in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, I think Neil's points are really important. His team needs to know what the cameras are going to look like, because he needs to know if they're going to see Trump blathering or not. The CNN put out a test this morning. I don't know if you saw this clip, where you can actually hear the other person. It's just very faint. So you're not going to be able to understand the words, but you will hear if he's saying something. Anyway, all of this is things they have to consider about, do you want Biden to respond or not? My guess and suggestion would be, don't respond. Stick to what you're trying to get to, because the moment you veer off, you've lost your point, right? So much of this debate, again, is proving that you're competent, you have a plan, all of those things. If you're being guided by Trump, you're playing to his rules, which is ultimately what he wants. And just one thing on the person writing in, if you
John,
look at folks who are going to watch tonight based on the polls, you have a pretty low percentage, particularly of young people, again, who are really important, especially on the Democratic side of the aisle, who are saying they're actually going to watch.
And Danielle comments, I think debates matter. I definitely will be voting, but I cannot watch. I'll catch some highlights, which brings to the surface this question, Charles, of what actually matters in a debate. If you watch the whole thing, perhaps it's the comportment of the candidates overall, how you feel about how they talked. But if you're not watching, then what matters might be a viral moment or two. So what do you think matters more, sort of the overall debate performance or the one or two things that get grabbed the next day?
This debate matters because it may be the only one of the election. So there is one as it stands scheduled for September 12th of ABC, but who knows if that happens, especially with how tonight may or may not go. So it matters in the sense of we have social media now with Instagram, for example, reels that will be exploited by both sides, viral clips sent and fed to people who aren't watching tonight. And a lot of the people who will watch tonight are those older voters who are already tuning in for hours to cable news every night. So in terms of older voters, they'll watch the whole thing. Younger voters, they may skip and catch the clips on Instagram.
But if younger voters, Kelly, you're saying they're the ones that Biden really needs to get back, then, I mean, what can he really do tonight? That feels like a sort of powerless situation to be in for him.
Well, I think Neil's earlier point about, you know, style versus substance, I think obviously that is true for debates. But there is something about some specific issues and what Biden needs to do for those younger voters. So on Israel and Hamas, that will be a clip. However he responds, that will be a question. However he responds, that will be clipped. And that will spread in these particular circles among this particular group of voters. The same is probably true for abortion and Trump, right? So on these issues, people are going to be ready to clip those, and it matters then the exact words and the way in which that candidate speaks to those issues, because I think that will be the thing that that group of voters is both potentially persuaded by, and by persuaded, I mean persuaded to vote or not.
Yeah.
And then also the thing that they see.
And Neil, I want to bring you into the conversation because this is a critical moment for both candidates to try to tap into some key constituencies like younger voters, but also Black and Latino voters, something that both candidates have been targeting groups. You see Trump in inner city. He was here in Philadelphia a few days ago doing speaking in Atlanta at barbershops and all sorts of things. What do you think can be like some of the messaging that both of the candidates could use? And you could start with Biden and go to Trump.
Well, the race is deadlocked. I mean, and especially in the seven states, the race is deadlocked. And, you know, all you can say about those states is it's close. The margin of error goes up when the numbers get closer to 50-50. So if you have a poll that says Sherry is winning 80-20, there's no margin of error.
If that would be the poll if we were just talking about Studio 2 popularity.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But if you had a poll that said, you know, the race like in Pennsylvania is 47-47, the margin of error goes up to 5.5 points. My point is that what is going to change the dynamic? The election is 18 weeks from Tuesday.
Yeah.
Unless something happens, quote, in the real world, Russia goes crazy, or, you know, something happens in the real world. This is one of the two times, this and the other, that the dynamic of the race might change, that something happens for 90 minutes that really will change the dynamic of the race, whether it is messaging, somebody says something, or whether, you know, you asked, is it a single moment or is it the whole thing? In the first Gore-Bush race, and we did Al Gore's first presidential campaign, in the first Bush-Gore race, Gore was Joanne Woodward in The Three Faces of Eve. You know, she won the Academy Award. He was bizarre. And Bush blew him away. You know, younger George Bush blew him away and, you know, ended up winning the campaign. Or you'll have viral moments like Lloyd Benson saying to Dan Quayle, you know.
You're no Jack Kennedy.
Right. I mean, I knew Jack Kennedy. I served with Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. You're no Jack Kennedy. And that completely defined Dan Quayle for the rest of the campaign. So we'll see. But
inroads in those key constituencies?
I don't know.
No? The
issue is there might be if somebody screws up an answer, more likely. But remember, in the 90 minutes, how many questions are going to be asked about, you know, where are you with Hispanics or what are you going to do for the Hispanic? I mean, you know, there's so few. It's not as if you could have a half hour where you just talk about minorities. And so I don't know how much will change. Right.
And Kelly, you want to
comment on that?
Yeah, I just
wanted to speak to that in the terms of if you look back to 2020, debate one was the stand back and stand by moment, right?
Talking about the Proud Boys.
The Proud Boys call out from Trump. And so that, speaking to this issue of race and racism, not just these constituencies, but broadly speaking, I think one of what things Biden has to do tonight is point to a contrast. Mm-hmm. You know, Trump is trying to reach out to these communities, but at the same time, here are the things he's done in the past. Here are the things he's said. Here are the policies he's put forward. That contrast has to come through for Biden because of this counter messaging that Trump's trying to do. And so there is a possibility of that direct confrontation or pushing Trump to respond to, you know, his policies on immigration, his policies in urban areas, the comments he's made about folks who are Black Lives Matter protesters. Like, is there a part of this debate where Biden can put him on the spot on
Charles,
those things?
You seem like you've got something on your mind right there.
Well, no, I mean, look, tonight when it comes to Black and Hispanic voters alone, I mean, at this stage of this race, the polling clearly shows that Biden has a serious problem. Mm-hmm. New York Times just came out with Black voters polling for Trump at 30%. We haven't seen those numbers since Nixon in 1960. Hispanics, likewise, polling, they trust Trump over Biden on immigration. Mm. Biden's going to go on the stage tonight and come across as this force of stability, but he's targeting households that hardly feel stable. They're financially unstable. and his hyper-focused message, one that Mike Donilon, his top aide, has said that they're all in on, using 2004 as a model when Bush employed 9/11 as the hyper-focus at that time. For Biden, they're hyper-focused on democracy and January 6th. But if you talk to any Hispanic voter in Pennsylvania, and I've extensively reported on Hispanic vote in the state, nobody is talking about that. And there are 600,000 Hispanic voters in Pennsylvania. And if activated, that could be a game changer in the state. But really, when it comes to that talk about democracy, January 6th, that only really works for Biden's base that will be the viewers tonight, voters over age 65, boomers who live in the suburbs, who are living in the houses that they lived in 30 years ago. They look at Biden as a force of stability, as a status quo. And I think it's underrated that when it comes to Zoomers, Hispanic voters, Black voters, they're not looking for the status quo because their lives are in financial tumult. They're looking for disruptive change. And Trump just happens to be the guy.
A former
on stage
president
tonight.
Will represent disruptive change.
Interesting. Let me reintroduce our panel. We're talking about the debate coming up tonight. We've been talking with, you just heard, Charles McElwee, founding editor of Real Clear Pennsylvania. We've also got Kelly Dittmar, associate professor of political science at Rutgers Camden, and Neil Oxman, Democratic strategist. If you want to join our conversation, 888-477-9499 or studio2@whyy.org. I want to talk about expectation setting. There's a little weird game going on right now, it seems, specifically around how Trump has framed Biden, because he's talked about him as old and infirm, even having dementia in many ads that you see run on TV. And yet in recent days, it seems like his camp is walking that back, saying he's a great debater, he's a worthy opponent. What's going on there, Neil?
Expectations matter in the sense that if somebody does better than you think they're going to do, you know, it's a thing. And no matter what Trump has tried to do in the last 2 or 3 days, clearly the burden of proof in this campaign is on Biden. It's on Biden because of his age. And as I said, that's baked in. And that's more important than your answer about, you know, tariffs. You know, Biden had a great moment at the State of the Union. He wasn't an old man at the State of the Union. The question is, how is he going to come off tonight that, as Charles says, stability, but maybe, you know, broadens. Sherry, the problem with – I do Democrats. I've done 750 Democratic campaigns. How many times can Democrats say to the Black and Hispanic community, quote, this is the most important election of your lifetime, and then nothing changes, which is why you have diminishing turnout among you. Dave Davis is tired of hearing me say this. The single biggest predictor of voting is age. It's not income and education. It's age. Yeah. You know, and then it becomes income and education. And so, you know, why is a 24-year-old African-American who lives at 17th and Diamond Street, who's, you know, what stake does he have in voting? Just because the Democrats say it's the most important election of your lifetime?
Yeah. And I will say this. I've talked to a lot of voters of color, and a lot of them have talked about Biden's age as a reason why they can't get with it. And so I want to extend what you were saying, Neil, and extend it a little bit more to ask this follow-up. How does Biden go about acknowledging the fact that he is in his 80s at this point, but not seem old? Because you can be aged, but not old. Yeah. So how do you walk that line? Yeah. Kelly?
I mean, I think you've seen him try to do that. I think,
and that will help some with some voters of color.
Well, Reagan did that famously in the second debate against Mondale, where, you know, which was actually, there's a guy in Philadelphia who helped coach him that night, but who said, you know, I'm not going to let my opponent's age and experience.
Right.
I mean, and people laughed, but you liked Ronald Reagan. I mean, the presidential campaigns are largely, from modern times, popularity contests. We like to vote for people we like. And with a couple of exceptions, Nixon being one, Johnson being one, if you think about all the elections, starting with Franklin Roosevelt, we like the people we've elected, we like more than the other people. Mm. And, you know, Joe Biden is likable. He's not an unlikable person. But You know,
I
wouldn't try to be anything I wasn't. Mm. And yes, you probably Charles. I mean, Charles is a good historian about this. What to do to make it where people laugh? Because if people laugh, then they like you.
I just want to jump in on this because I think part of the age thing, I'm saying we as a collective, we have bought into. They are 3 years different.
Yeah.
Part of this is that the Trump campaign has done a great job. You have to give credit to making this an issue for Biden and not making this an issue for Trump. When you watch Trump at his rallies, there is a lot of weaving and confusion and but that's his style, supposedly. Right. That has nothing to do with age with him. The expectation has been set differently. And so our response is different. It doesn't make it easier for Biden.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. And we only have about 5 minutes left in this whole show. So I got to ask you, Valerie comments, how will Biden talk about Trump's conviction and how would it impact Trump's presidency? Charles, we got to talk about the felony conviction. We got to talk about the outstanding indictments. How this is going to be a big issue for Trump. How should each candidate address it?
Well, for Trump, I mean, the polling indicates it hasn't changed anything. The Times came out yesterday. 2/3 of voters are their position is completely unchanged post-conviction. So even with the pending cases and everything else, I think this race has consistently shown that dynamic of the campaign is really not shifting the ground. And if anything, the day after the conviction in New York, Trump raised $34 million. It appears to have been a game-changing moment financially for his campaign.
So should Trump talk about it more? Is that what you're saying? Or should Biden not talk about it?
They'll both talk about it tonight. I think both will embrace it.
How should Biden talk about it?
Well, they're speaking to different voters, right? And so that's part of it. So which voters are going to respond to which message? So Biden will, because he wants to do the contrast, right? This is what you get with me. This is what you get with this guy. And let me remind you of all of the things and baggage he brings. Let me remind you he could be in jail before he gets into office. There will be that extreme contrast. But he knows that that's not trying to get a Trump voter. That's trying to mobilize his base.
I think what you just said, Charles, made me think about something larger, about this whole debate, this whole campaign, which is that people seem pretty set on who they like and who they're going to vote for. And yet the polls are very, very close from what we've seen so far. And so you could argue on one hand that none of this matters, but then you could argue on the other hand, it matters a ton because if you can move the tiniest group of people, you can get yourself over the finish line. Between those two competing visions I've laid out, Charles, which one do you favor?
So let's map out the scenario tonight that the average viewer is older. That could prove favorable toward Biden, all things considered, because polling has shown the Wall Street Journal recently Trump was at 46%, Biden 50%, weaker than where Trump was in 2020. And Republicans have won the senior vote consistently since 2000. So if the viewership trends older and if Trump has viral moments that are akin to those, let's say, in that first debate, like the clip you shared from 2020, and that comes across even awkwardly with the mute situation – that's where that can help Biden.
Yeah,
and we only have a minute, so I want to give you each 15 seconds. Kelly and Neil, will this debate matter?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how much it's going to matter in the scheme of things. We've got too much time before Election Day, but I would look at, does it generate energy for Biden, particularly among those who are disaffected?
Yeah, and final word, Neil, will it matter?
If somebody screws up. It matters.
Now I better nail the end of this show right now because I don't want to screw up myself. All right, so you heard from Neil Oxman, Democratic political strategist, Kelly Dittmar, associate professor of political science at Rutgers Camden, and Charles McElwee, editor of Real Clear Pennsylvania. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thanks.
And that ends today's episode of Studio 2. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered today's show. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and let's mention you can watch or listen live to the debate tonight at 9 on WHYY-TV 12 or on WHYY-FM.